Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. In 1949, EQMM began supporting and encouraging new writers by establishing a Department of First Stories, a space reserved in each issue for a story by a previously unpublished writer. In 1983, the yearly Robert L. Fish Memorial Award for Best Short Story by a New American Writer was established for the Mystery Writers of America. In the years since, a number of stories from EQMM's Department of First Stories have won the Fish Award, including last year's remarkably accomplished first fiction by Zoe Z. Dean, a pseudonym of Kentucky resident Lauren James. Here is the author reading her winning story, Getaway Girl, from EQMM's November 2014 issue.
What happened with Maylin Grange was unusual. There was a lot of talk about it at the time, and it was a funny thing because there wasn't any doubt about the facts in question. What we speculated on was what was in her head then and if it could have justified her. Of course, it was worse because she was a woman. I heard that from people all over town. Roland assigned me the case when it was first called in. Back then, the only one involved that we knew of was Billy Cord. Every small town has a Billy Cord. These boys grow up knowing no one will ever call them William but the judge. Billy Cord had grown up pinching Mounds bars and cans of spray paint from every gas station within town limits, and by the time he was 16, he had graduated to setting cats on fire at their tails and running cigarettes and cans of chewing tobacco across state lines. He was always going to be trouble, and it would have been wrong to blame him for it, because he never could have helped it. Roland, who was at church more Sundays than me, said Billy had the mark of Cain. Billy came into his destiny on the 5th of July when a firework he had popped off in the dead-empty parking lot of the shuttered Fastburger had gone into his best friend's eye and blinded him. Billy shot him in the head. It was an escalation, but with a little imagination, I could see how he would have gotten to it. Terence Poe had grown up hand and fist with Billy, and I would think that if Billy had planned to shoot him, he would have done it before then. It was more likely that Terence Poe was the only person Billy gave a damn about, and seeing him bleed and listening to him scream, as he must have done, shook him, and boys like Billy Cord have only one response to being shaken. He must have known the heat would come down on him then, so he ran. He filled up at the Speedy Gas heading out of town, bought 6 or 7 Mounds bars, and took a hostage. Maylin Grange had been working there for about 3 months at that point. Like I said, all of this is written down, and how he took her is even on camera. It didn't look like she enjoyed herself much. She struggled, got her a cut just above her left eye. It bled down into her field of vision like a red sheet. That isn't something you can see, but I've watched that footage a dozen times over the last 3 years, and like I said, all it takes is a little imagination. Billy in his oil-stained denim jacket and Maylin in her red polo shirt that hid the blood. He put her behind the wheel and made her drive. She took them out of town at a steady 40. Anything more or less, any attempt to draw attention and hook in police out of a speed trap, she said later, and maybe he would have shot her. She had to be careful of that. She had to be as careful as she could be, and as clever as she could be, because she wanted to live. I could see even then that what it was, really, was a fairy tale, as much as it was two kids not even old enough to drink, not even past pimples, in a car headed west. Billy said, "West where I always should have been, anyway." He put the gun on his knees and stared out the window at the hills they were passing by, like in the Gold Rush. The Gold Rush everyone got in 10th grade history, which meant Billy had learned about it by only about 2 months. But Maylin could see that the idea of it had grown in his head like a weed. She said, "Are you thinking California?" "California," Billy said. His voice was as light as whipped butter. He had been thinking it all right, but he couldn't admit to it because, as he said after, he knew that California was nothing but fags and movie stars, and he wanted to seem like he was like to vomit over both. Even though Billy and Terence Poe had spent whatever they had left after weed and liquor on movie tickets, and even though Billy's uncle, who had half-raised him, was queer, partnered up for over a dozen years with a steel worker with hands like catcher's mitts, and Billy ate dinners with them on Sundays. Maylin said she didn't know was how Billy wanted to leave the state. "That gets federals involved," she said. "What's the matter to you?" "The longer you stay alive," Maylin said, "the longer I stay alive. We both don't want nothing but a clean getaway." Maylin's hair was dishwater blonde, and it had always been so thin you could see her scalp through it, pinkish like rabbit eyes. I had gone to school with her older brother and even let him take me out a time or two, and he had said Maylin, just 11 then, made his skin crawl in the same way those hairless dogs did, like there was something about her too weak to bear. She never was a pretty girl, but I suppose when she said getaway, she started looking about as pretty to Billy Cord as she ever could. Because Billy knew he wasn't smart, the one thing you could say about the boy was that he had a healthy appreciation for his own limitations, and he thought all ugly girls had to be, like boys in glasses, or boys with bones and voices like reeds. It's a foolish thing to think, but there it is, all the same. a kind of nobility in the working of it, the idea that God wouldn't deny a girl her beauty without giving her brains to make up for it. And Maylin was smart, too, which is what people fault her with, as much as they fault her with being a woman and with being ugly. It's hard to trust a woman clicking away like that behind the eyes, Roland said to me about it, and then he swore mildly and said, "Nothing I meant, Beth." I didn't trust Maylin either, though. I respected her. I'm not what you call pretty, either. Where it all went wrong, if you exclude Terence Poe with his eye gone and his brains out on the asphalt here in town, is when they stopped for burgers on account of how Billy hadn't got anything in the speedy gas except for candy bars. That was before he had Maylin to plan for him. She talked him into stopping so she could use the bathroom, and so, she said, he wouldn't be running on sugar and caffeine, which would make him jittery and less reasonable than ever. It was a McDonald's, one of about half a dozen where they were, in Plymouth, a little ways off from Murray, which is where I went to school. Neither Maylin or Billy had ever mentioned anything about it, but I expect they planned it, which is to say that Maylin planned it, them going around Murray like that and through Mayfield instead. Mayfield is poorer and has a larger immigrant population not keen on calling the police for anything. Murray is richer, and older, too, full of people who watch the TV all day and don't mind at all getting mixed up in other people's troubles. Plymouth is on the skirts of Mayfield, which is to say it's close to Mayfield's bare legs, it not being a town with much spread to it. It was cautious enough, stopping there, and stopping at a place that would, that time of day, be busy enough for no one to mind them, but Maylin decided that what would give her the best cover and the best chance of staying alive would be something more than caution. She went to the bathroom, peed, and scrubbed the blood out of her shirt as best she could. Of course, Billy had looked in first to make sure there were no women in there she could have begged to sell from, and the room had been empty. He had waited outside, and it must have been then that the taking of Maylin had started to seem to him like something fortuitous. Any other McDonald's in Plymouth would have had a restroom with at least one other woman in it, whether she was in heels or a screen-printed sweatshirt, but not this one, not on Maylin's recommendation that they stop. Chance smiled on him. Maylin even got the blood out of her collar. Billy ordered for both of them, his back ramrod straight, like it was the bravest thing he'd ever done to assume he knew what a woman wanted. It's a kind of confidence I can always do without. But there was, towards the end with him, a fumbling kindness towards Maylin. And if he wanted to provide for her, he wanted to provide everything, because he ordered bag upon bag of carry-out hamburgers, chicken nuggets, fish fillets, and all the rest. It was lunch hour, and the restaurant had that flat golden light from the noon sun, and everyone inside was sweating. It smelled like French fry oil and milkshakes, that clean vanilla smell. Maylin said, quietly, "You should take their money." The way she told it later was that she worried over two things, Billy running out of money and the police running out of Billy. And for the time she was with him, her life was a tightrope strung between the two. First, the people next to her stopped talking, and from there the silence spread, until the people at the back tables had hushed, not because they knew what was about to happen, but because the quiet had come against them like a wave, and they had gotten aware, late, of how their own voice was the only sound besides the ding of the cash register. I worked fast food in high school, and after a while, I stopped hearing the customers. I would be halfway through returning change and realize that I didn't know what they'd said, or what I'd told the boys at the grill to make. That must have been how it was with Rachel Bick, 17, who kept on sliding Billy and Maylin's cheeseburgers into bags a few seconds after Billy took out his gun and aimed it straight at the bridge of her nose. The specificity of the angle and her shortness, for she was one of those dainty, well-made girls, doll-like in her construction, is a detail she gave, but most of the media neglected, but it was what I always thought of. The bullet would have broken her nose first. "You heard the lady," Billy Cord said, except Rachel Bick hadn't. She didn't need to, though. A gun to the head presents itself succinctly enough. She started digging out cash, and Billy broke the hold on her nose to gesture with the gun to everyone else to help with the others, too. It wasn't an advantageous position, him being in the middle of the restaurant with a dozen patrons behind him, slack-jawed, mouths full of beef and potato, when any one of them might have had a gun of their own. Kentucky is a concealed carry state, and while I have an eye for who is holding and who isn't, I can't believe I was equaled in that by Billy Cord. I asked Maylin later if she had counted on someone shooting him, but she said no one could have, and I'm not surprised that she knew who could and couldn't have. She said the robbery would tell the state police that she and Billy had made it as far as Plymouth, and that it would give Billy enough ready cash that his thoughts wouldn't yet turn desperate, because desperate boys did desperate things, and Billy was already in the habit of killing when fear and love got the better of him. Billy was getting the money, and Maylin was using her purse to hold it all, and I've heard people say they were trying to be like Bonnie and Clyde, but I don't believe it. That was Billy's dream of them, that was all, and he grew up with ringworm, lice, and misconceptions, and he couldn't have told anyone how that movie ended, or how Barrow and Parker did. Anyway, Bonnie and Clyde would have planned farther ahead. Billy had one hand down in Maylin's purse when someone behind them knocked their soda off the table. The straw popped out onto the floor. I see it, lying there in a sticky puddle of Diet Coke, looking like a pickup stick somebody had forgotten. Billy spun around, his arm up, the gun at the end of it like an exclamation point. And at this point, someone took a picture with her phone and the flash got in his eyes. I would like to think they planned that, too, but I can't be sure, and they've never said so, and some people are relentless with documenting themselves, even though two of the people in that McDonald's had pissed themselves already. Scared or not, someone must have thought there needed to be a picture, and so there was. Billy Cord with one lean arm out, and May Lynn behind him. I've seen it online over 100 times when I haven't even been looking. Billy looks scared, but he also looks like someone popped a firecracker off behind him, and the shock and smoke of it has got Terrence in his head as much as it's jolted him. He looks like someone's hurt him, been rude. He was always thin-skinned. It takes a lot for a boy to kill his best friend, kidnap a girl, hold up a restaurant, and still look like he's been done wrong, but Billy Cord had the face that could manage it. And looking at the picture, I do feel sorry for him in his stunted, faded life. In a town where we all weren't surprised by what happened with him, or if we were, how we were only surprised by May Lynn. Billy, like I said, had a tenderness to him. And if it was a tenderness that pitched his back into digging himself deeper and deeper holes, it was a tenderness, too, that made me want to help him out of them. And the truth is now that no one talks about Billy Cord the way they talk about May Lynn Grange. Looked at too closely, the boy disappears, becomes a footnote. When I saw that picture, I told Roland that we would have to try to bring him in alive, even as screwed up as he was. But though I felt sorry for him, it's not his story I'm telling. Because back in that McDonald's, May Lynn pushed his arm down. It was just a drink, she said, over and over, like Billy had thought it was a gunshot, and maybe he had. It was just a drink, Billy, just a drink. He didn't mean to. And Billy's muscles relaxed one by one until his features softened altogether, and everyone there must have wanted to kiss May Lynn's shoes for it. They were on their way out then, with the story seeming only one way. May Lynn was briefly beautiful in that flat yellow sunlight, having saved the life of a man whose muscles were still jumping from the closeness of the bullet. And if they had left then, everyone would have said that she was a hero, a lady. But May Lynn had taken the greasy bags of food and money, and the dull orange wrapper of a roll of quarters was sticking out of her purse like a panic button, when her eyes lit on the bulkier man in the back of the place, the man in a blue shirt so faded it had gone to gray. He had a clip-on black tie, and his hand was down around his waist. She recognized him. May Lynn had worked in shopping malls before. She once had bagged what I bought at Macy's, sliding it inside its long plastic sheath, as carefully as if it were a wedding dress. And she knew that the security guards were all dressed as alike as dolls. She also knew, and this is what I come back to time and again, that they didn't carry guns, not even in Kentucky. What he had was a walkie-talkie set to a police radio frequency. May Lynn wanted the police to find her and Billy, but she didn't want Billy to know they were coming, and how could he not hear the call in a little restaurant like that? I would say that he couldn't have, though, not with the blood beating in his ears the way it must have been. And the man might not have radioed in until the two of them were out the door. In fact, I think it almost impossible that he wouldn't have waited, and what's more, I think May Lynn thought so, too. She just wasn't a girl interested much in taking chances. She didn't want there to be a hostage situation, one where Billy might kill her the way he had killed Terrence. She wanted to convince him she was on his side. These things, she thought, had been thinking ever since he'd escorted her out of the speedy gas at gunpoint and bloodied her nose, would save her life. So when the guard went for his radio, May Lynn said, "Billy," and pointed. The man dropped his hand. He had pink skin, the color of ham. Billy said, "What?" I put myself there. Like I said, imagination. So I could hear it, the way everyone in the McDonald's described it, that bead of silence between Billy's question and May Lynn's answer. Because Billy Cord had never been sharp, he had needed to ask her, and by then the man's hand was already away from the radio. The back of his collar was soaked through with sweat. May Lynn said he was going to call the police. She was their sweetheart for just a minute or two, but that broke their hearts like they'd put their trust in her, and here she was, come up wanting. She surprised them as rudely as if she'd stuck her foot out to trip them. They all seemed embarrassed by their misjudgment of her when they talked about it later. He shot the guard. It didn't surprise anyone, which is one more reason why I pity him. No one ever expected better. They talked more about May Lynn and what she had said, and how she had pointed her neat, clear-glossed fingernail, the blood they wanted on her hands. Billy is the one who will die for the guard's shooting and for Terrence Poe's, but Billy isn't the one who mattered, and that's the last I'll say about it, I suppose. I just remember him, is all. I remember him as a kid with a ring of dirt around his neck and a habit of turning up to follow my boyfriends around, a habit that stuck, puppy-like. I don't remember May Lynn much at all. Like I said, her brother didn't like her. Like I said, she'd been precise and smooth in how she'd bagged that dress I bought. And with all our time together in the same town, that's all I could have said of her before she got taken out of that gas station and put in all our heads. She pointed at him, Roland said, when we made it to the McDonald's. Hell. Billy shot him, I said. Billy Cord's a pistol. I'm more interested in who's pulling the trigger. He kidnapped her. It's all on tape. I doubt she played along just for the hell of it, not the way he smashed the barrel into her face like that. Some girls you never know about. Billy started crying in the car. There never was much about him that was stoic, however many John Wayne movies he watched, and May Lin was surprised by how messily, that was her word, he gave himself over to feeling things. There were snot bubbles in his nose. He had run away too soon after Terence to have cried for him, and probably the sobbing fit, on one more rubber-burning run out of town, was as much or more for Terence as it was for the security guard, Timothy Green. Billy had shot him through the left lung. They were veering all over the road. "It's all right," Maylin kept saying. "It's okay. It's all right. It's what you had to do, Billy. Don't you know that?" She petted him like he was a dog, skinny enough for his ribs to show, half feral, but one that kept rubbing against her all the same, and she spoke that kind of thing to him until he quieted. The car pulled a little more smoothly into the right-hand lane. Billy's eyes were still rimmed red, and Maylin noticed then that they were even redder than they should have been, because he was, of all things, getting over pink eye, contracted a few days back. Terence had had it, too. I saw it in the autopsy. It was mostly gone by the time Billy shot Terence and ran, but the crying had revived that lurid hot pinkness, and Maylin could see the gunk at the corners of his eyes, as overwhelming to her in its way as the snot. She said, later, that he disgusted her. That part everyone has always believed. "I didn't want to shoot anybody," Billy said finally, which wasn't true, since he'd been carrying a gun before and after his parole, and since he'd been talking about killing someone, anyone, since he was 14, although usually people thought he must have meant his daddy, and maybe he did. "He was going for the radio," Maylin said. Billy falling apart could spell good for her, or it could spell bad, and again, she didn't want the risk of bad, of him killing her the way he'd killed Terence, out of guilt. He should have known better. "I'll go to hell." "Not for doing what you have to do," she said. "Not for doing it to someone who should have known better. The thing is, Billy, he didn't have compassion. He didn't see that you weren't bad, and that's the worst thing there is, not seeing that. You and me, we're in trouble, and what did he want to do? Just kick you while you're down. You think McDonald's needs that money? They got enough money. We need that money. And you didn't shoot that man who dropped the drink. You showed them that you were going to do right, as much as you could, but what did he do? He still tried to bring the cops down on you. Billy, you needed that money. We needed it. And he didn't understand. He didn't even try. He was the one who did wrong, not you. I promise. Billy breathed, even and steady. Maylin said, "The next time it needs doing, you should make me do it." "I should make you do it," he said, and he shaped the words like he shaped them ordering Chinese food, where he didn't exactly understand what they meant, just knew what the sounds were. "You'll know you can trust me then. If I kill somebody, they'll be after me too. They'll say I'm with you. Then you'll know I'll be helping you run. You'll know it for sure." She leaned back in her seat. Billy's car was dirty, all cigarette butts on the floor, fabric ripped, stuffing protruding in yellow foam puffs, breaking through the cloth in waves. She managed to settle back like she was on a throne. "The next time you know we got to, you ought to make me be the one, not you, and that'll be what's best for us." Billy looked over at her. Nobody had ever forgiven him anything before, let alone said that he had been right. He had a conscience easy enough to gainsay, for love, and after that, he loved her. I know that from the peach he bought her, and from what she says. She isn't trustworthy, Maylin, but on that score I believe her all the same. They went to a motel that night. It was independently run, one long strip of peeling stucco and cracked brick, and Maylin, her face still not as known as Billy's, not as pushed on TV, went inside to get them a room. The reception was all glass-fronted, so Billy, out in the car, could have kept a gun on her, if he had wanted to. My guess is he didn't, but Maylin says she couldn't have known for sure. She got them the room without making a fuss. Billy was solicitous to her. He gave her the bed and slept sitting up in the armchair, the gun level on his thigh. And when she got up to go to the bathroom and to scope out how heavy a sleeper he was, he always stirred, pink eyelids fluttering up. She risked nothing except those bathroom runs, three of them, because they had gorged themselves in the car on the fast food, and then again in the motel on candy from the vending machines, and she had diarrhea that felt like it would split her open. Billy had dodged it, the only point of weakness he really ever missed. A strong stomach, that way of looking at it. Maylin tore a sheet of hotel paper off the back of the notepad, figuring that it wasn't like Billy to miss it, and figuring she'd pass it off as a souvenir if he did. She wrote out a note in the bathroom. "My name is Maylin Grange, and I've been kidnapped by a man named Billy Cord. He has a gun. I'm going to try and get him to head east again in the morning towards Lexington." It went on like that for a bit. She gave the license plate number of the car, which she hadn't recommended they trade in, and she talked about what roads they might take. She said that Billy was armed and that he was going to make her kill if anyone pressed down on them, so anyone who tried to stop them had to do it right and with overwhelming force. Those were the words she used, those last two. Overwhelming force. In the morning, while Billy pissed and brushed his teeth with his finger, Maylin left her note inside the Gideon Bible. She got the idea because Billy had checked it when they'd first gotten there, flipping through it for money, since he'd heard the Gideons left 20s inside them sometimes as a reward for spiritual endeavors. They don't. No reward outside salvation. Local cops were in the parking lot of the motel, but only one car, David Rogan and his partner, Tim Bryce. Bryce was only 6 months into the job, and Rogan, though a lifer, was the kind of man who checks his watch waiting for his pension, the kind of cop I'd condemn more if, lately, I didn't so resemble him. It was Rogan who spotted the plates on a drive past the lot and decided to make the stop, and it had been May Lynn's doing that the car was parked with its bumper out towards the road, the mud on the plate washed clean off by the rain, the way she had been hoping. I can go back and back like that through a chain. Rogan did radio in his position and request backup, but it was morning, almost checkout time, and he clocked Billy and Maylin in the lobby, turning in their keys. Rogan stopped them when they were coming out. Bryce was just a couple feet behind him. Billy said, "Oh, shit." I said before that none of the facts of the case were in dispute, all of them corroborated by Billy Cord and Maylin at the least, and some of them by other witnesses, that all that people had to talk over was Maylin and whether or not she had gotten more of a thrill than she should have, and collaborated more than she should have, and been the reason behind more of it, in the end, than Billy himself. But I suppose there is vagueness in what happened in that parking lot, because the gun was in Billy's hand, and then it was in Maylin's. Maylin said Billy pushed it on her, and Billy says he must have, she says so. For the rest of the story, what they both said together generally seemed like enough of the truth, but what matters to a lot of people is whether or not he gave the gun to her or she grabbed it. I don't think it matters much to her, honestly. She said of it what she said of everything else, that she was only doing what she had to do to live and to convince Billy she was worth keeping around so she didn't end up dropped dead in some roadside patch of woods. I do think she took it. It was maybe the sensible thing to do. Bryce was like Billy, excitable, and Rogan wasn't, maybe, as competent as he should have been. She could not have trusted them with her life as much as she could have trusted herself, and she had already told Billy that them killing together would prove her value to him. It could have been just something to say at the time, but here was the opportunity, the way that the opportunity had been in McDonald's, a chance to ingratiate herself further, to prove that she wasn't on anybody's side but his. She shot Rogan twice in the chest and then Bryce once in the arm, incapacitating him. I can see how it would have made sense to her. Rogan had to die to protect them for sure and to prove her point to Billy. Bryce had to live, if possible, so he could tell everyone about the motel, that it was them. How else would they have found the note? Blood popped out of Bryce's arm, not like sweat, but like a wad of gum, thick and bubbled. And Maylin kept saying, "Go, go, go," until Billy went, and they left streaks of rubber in the parking lot. Bryce lost a lot of blood. A person can die from being shot in the shoulder the same as they can die from being shot anywhere else, contrary to what it seems like in the movies. But he still managed to make it to the radio first and call his physician and his suspects in. "They shot me," he said, for whatever that's worth. They, and not she. Maylin didn't mean to kill him, but he died all the same, slumped against the side of his car. I suspect he would have made a decent officer under any other circumstances, but the ones in which he died made him a kind of hero. Meanwhile, Billy and Maylin drove. Maylin didn't cry. She said later she was in shock. Roland called her heartless, but I have to think about why she wouldn't just say she cried when she hadn't. Because Billy might say otherwise, and she needed their stories to be consistent right down to that last detail, that last dried tear stain on her cheek. Because she was proud, a little, of how well she'd stayed together, because she didn't understand it herself. I shot a meth cook when I was a year and a half into the job. He was waving a pistol around, shooting at the air, and the odds were good he was too high to hit anything. But a cop, a decent one or even a lazy one, can't abide someone else spraying bullets. Too much risk, which helped me understand Maylin's calculations. I shot him the way she shot Rogan, twice, neatly. Maylin went to a shooting range, which is not the same one I did. Though after everything that happened with Billy, I made a point of seeking hers out and seeing if I could ever get next to her while we were firing. I couldn't. It seems like she gave it up. In the car, Maylin was still, and Billy was vibrating and shaking like a washing machine. It doesn't take long, with some, for them to cast aside how bad they feel about killing and find the adrenaline and the smell of cordite and the luxury of living. And Billy was in love, which was the other thing. They drove closer to Lexington, the way Maylin had said they would, and after a few hours, Billy stopped at a farmer's market. As late in the day as it was by that point, almost everything good was gone. Farmers' markets are like goodness. You have to get there early if you want anything, other than scraps, so mealy-seeming it's hard to tell if they're worth the trouble of buying them at all. But Billy didn't know even as much about farmers' markets as he knew about goodness, and so he bought Maylin a peach, a small, wrinkled thing, tough as wood, but a golden pink color, like it was lit from the inside out. "I bought you this," he said, as proudly as a boy bringing a drawing to his mother. She looked it over. "What did you do that for?" "Because you're my sweet getaway girl," he said. After that, it was almost over. State police surrounded Billy and Maylin when they stopped for gas in Lexington. Maylin told Billy they were out of choices except to come out with their hands up and live, live to be together, and she must have sold it, and he must have loved her, because they're both alive, and he's in prison still, writing her faithfully every week, even though she never writes back. She made him believe her, she made him love her, and so she lived, which was all she wanted. It's as hard to quarrel with that kind of logic as it is to love it. They arrested Maylin at first, too, but she got herself a lawyer and a social worker, and between Billy's testimony, the note in the Gideon Bible, and what the people at the McDonald's said about her, the DA decided it wasn't worth it to push it through. People on the coast were paying attention and looking hard at it, saying it wasn't right what was happening to Maylin, on account of nothing more than her playing along to keep whole. No one wants that kind of publicity. Here, though, people talk about Maylin like she had a moral obligation to either die or to love Billy back, and either would have been less disconcerting to them than what she did instead. Her family doesn't talk to her much, but then again, they never did. Roland cooperated with that writer who came through a few months after the fact, and who wrote an expose about her, Getaway Girl, saying how she might have been in on it from the start, a sociopath out to use Billy in the world. It sold well. Roland's quoted a lot in it. I never talked to the writer, but I did talk to Maylin about 7 months after the fact. I went to her house and told her I just needed to clear up a few loose ends. It was bullshit, and I suppose she knew that, but she let me in all the same, maybe on account of how I'd dated her brother all that time ago. I made like I had a few questions for her, mostly about what Billy had said about Terence Poe, since that was about as close as any of the story had come to actually being my business. And once that was cleared up, she got me a Diet Coke from her fridge and we sat a while and talked. She had one of those Japanese Go games on her coffee table, and I asked her about it. "My niece, she's always talking about how she'd like to go to Japan," I said. "I bought her one of those for Christmas. She says it's harder than chess." Maylin nodded and sipped her Coke. She came from a good family and wouldn't brag on herself. "Still," I said, "can't be a lot of people around her who will give you a good match. It must get lonely." She shrugged. "Mostly I just play against myself." I nodded. The wind blew a little and shook the screen door. She looked at me, placid, and I thought about that game board and how she had thrown away the peach Billy had given her, the sweet getaway peach, and I knew that as much as I wanted to talk to her, to find out what was at the heart of her, the pit of her, I never would, and she would never tell me, would never confess. What was there to confess to, anyway? Only that there was something terrifying about a girl that good at living.
Getaway Girl is copyrighted by Zoe Z. Dean. Music for this podcast is by Tom Joad and was obtained from the Community Audio section of the Internet Archive. Mixing for the podcast was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.